he launched into our new theme for these Sangamites, which will carry on for months and months and months, in fact, for a year. So we'll be following it for some time to come, based on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So we're going to be using that as our framework, looking at Buddhism in terms of his, first of all, the historical Buddha, his life, his qualities, what he was like, stories from his life, the mythology surrounding him, looking at the Buddha as a symbol and an archetype that can help us to sort of engage with, imaginatively engage with enlightenment. And then we'll be looking at the Dharma, trying to get the basis of the Buddha's teachings, what we really need to practice, what's really going to work for us, but also hearing people's favourite Dharma teachings, people's favourite suttas, people's favourite texts. We'll be looking at the Sangha, so we'll be looking at the historical Sangha, famous Buddhists of the past and what we can learn from them, what we can, they can teach us. Looking at the principle of Sangha and how we can create spiritual community here and now. So we'll be expanding on this as we go along. We're using that as our framework. Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, what are called the three jewels of Buddhism. So they're called the three jewels, as Vajracchara said last week, they're called the three jewels in Buddhism because they are, because the Buddhists, they're precious, they're valuable. They're treasured. They're something we need to treasure. And we need all of them. So we need the ideal. We need the ideal of enlightenment. The ideal of the awakened human being. And the model and example of the Buddha. And then we need the Dharma, obviously. It's not much good having the ideal if we don't have the sort of down-to-earth instructions about how to move towards it. And we need, and neither of those would be much use without the Sangha, because we need the support of others to practice, and we need the Sangha as a sort of context in which we express, we can manifest more of what it would like to be enlightened. So these are the three jewels because they're completely central to Buddhism. They're completely central to living a meaningful life. So those are the three jewels of Buddhism, and it's not a coincidence that we've chosen these as our framework for the coming year. Just a little while after the Western Buddhist Order changed its name to the Triratna Buddhist Order. Triratna meaning, of course, in Sanskrit, the three jewels. So Triratna refers to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Tri meaning three, Ratna meaning jewel. I often wonder about the jewelers called the Ratna. I wonder whether there's a connection. So we call ourselves the Triratna Buddhist Order, the Three Jewels Buddhist Order, and the movement that used to be the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order is now the Triratna Buddhist Community, the community of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So the community that takes its central value, as its central values, the ideal of enlightenment, the teachings that lead to enlightenment, and the ideal of spiritual community and spiritual friendship. Those three ideals, that's what that is, the central of that community. Some of us might slightly mourn, including myself, might mourn the loss of the term Western, because Western was a very good description of our approach. If by Western we mean that we're trying to teach and practice a form of Buddhism suited to the contemporary world, which is increasingly based on what we might call Western culture. But Western is also a directional map, and we can hardly call ourselves Western when about a third of our order actually is in India. And in terms of people involved, in terms of people like friends and mitras involved, more people are involved in India, I would bet my bottom rupee, than in the rest of the world put together. Many, many more in the rest of the world put together. So on purely directional grounds, we can hardly call ourselves the Western Buddhist Order. But in a funny way, calling ourselves Triratna is getting at something very similar to what calling ourselves Western got at. The name Western sort of pointed to the fact that the three jewels are universal, the Dharma is universal. The Dharma isn't the exclusive product, province of any one culture or any one school. So that by getting back to the basic principles, the fundamental principles, the root principles of Buddhism, we could practice, we could forge a Buddhism that was suitable for the West, because we'd be finding what was universal. So you don't have to wear a yellow robe, or a red robe, or a black robe, or drink tea with rancid yak butter, or sit in full lotus position to practice the fundamental, universal principles of the Dharma. So the name Western pointed to the fact that we were about getting back to the roots, the root of Buddhism, the universal truth of Buddhism. And the name Sri Ratna gets at the same thing, because the three jewels symbolise the fundamental roots of Buddhism, from which it all grew, the roots from which everything else grew, the universal truths. They're the universal symbols shared by all Buddhists from different schools, different cultures, that are applicable and powerful in any culture and in any age. So it's getting the same thing. So that's why we're called the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order and the Tree Ratna Buddhist Community. We're seeking to get behind the cultural and historical differences that divide Theravada Buddhism from Southeast Asia, from Tibetan Buddhism, that divide the main schools of Tibetan Buddhism from each other, and from Chinese Buddhism, and from Japanese Buddhism, and in Japan divide Zen from Pure Land, from Shingon, from Tendai, etc., etc., etc. We're trying to get what's behind all of those. What's behind all of those is the universal principles of awakening, the way to awakening, and the spiritual community, so the three jewels. So we're asking ourselves, we're sort of engaged in this project of asking ourselves, what would awakening really look like and feel like and sound like to us now? What's the Buddha for us? What were the universal truths the Buddha taught that are applicable all the time, everywhere? And how can we make the path he's shown us work for us here and now? And how can we build a real spiritual community in the midst of this society, here and now? Not another one 2,500 years ago, but this one, right here and now. How can we make the three jewels real, here and now? That's what we're about, and that's why we're called the Tree Ratna Three Jewels Buddhist Order and the Three Jewels Buddhist Community, Tree Ratna Buddhist Community. And the title of tonight's talk sort of follows up on that link, and the link between the name of our spiritual community and the three jewels of Buddhism. So I gather the title of tonight's talk was billed as the Tree Ratna story, I think. So I'm going to tell you the Tree Ratna story. And I think Vajragupta, we actually asked Vajragupta to come from Birmingham to do this, which would tie in with his book that he's written called The Tree Ratna Story. But he's not here, so you have to make do with me. So what is the Tree Ratna story, and how does it link to our theme, the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Well, for a start, it links with the fact that the Tree Ratna story starts with the Buddha. It starts 2,500 years with the Buddha. And the Buddha was a radical. He was a wild man. He lived in a society where there was lots of religion, lots of concern for religion and spirituality, but he wanted to get to the root of what it was all about. And that is what radical means. It comes from the Latin, I think, radix, meaning a root. So a radical is someone who wants to cut away all the accretions to get to the truth, to get to the root of things, the real truth, the underlying truth. So the Buddha was a radical. He was asking, forget about all this traditional religion says. What are the universal principles? Let's get away from all the theorizing and all the philosophizing and all the speculation and all the metaphysical structures about this and that, and let's get back to what is the reality we live in that is right in front of our nose? What here and now, what is that reality like? How can we wake up to that reality? How can we escape from all the suffering when we refuse to relate to reality as it really is? How can we wake up? How can we see with naked, brilliant awareness right down to the way things really are? So he was a radical. He was a wild man. He lived in the woods. He encourages more hardcore followers to completely drop out of society. Completely drop their socially constructed ideas of themselves. To completely drop conventional social values, the conventional social values of his time, in order to break through to the truth. They lived a lot of the time in the forests, and they walked from place to place. They slept under trees. They gave up their old likes and dislikes. So they begged for their food, and they ate whatever they were given. They left their old social class, their caste, their status, their clan, completely behind, becoming a nobody in social terms. One epithet for the Buddha was the man of naught. I can't remember the Pali. The man of naught, the man of nothing. The man who is nothing, the nobody. The Buddha's Dharma was a teaching for people who wanted to be radical and who were willing to take big risks in order to live more meaningfully, who were willing to be a nobody. And his Sangha was a Sangha of radicals, of outsiders, who looked really scruffy and lived under trees. They were anything but respectable. So the Buddha was a wild man, a radical. And the Tree Ratna story starts with him. It starts with him and his teaching, which was a radical teaching, a radical path to the truth. And it starts with his Sangha, a Sangha of outsiders, of radicals. And then the story continues, the Tree Ratna story continues, with Sangharakshita, the founder of our order. And Sangharakshita is also a wild man. He's also a radical, he's also an outsider. So after the Second World War, he was drafted to India in the British Army. After the Second World War, he deserted, an illegal, risky act. Not the act of somebody who's concerned about their CV. He deserted from the British Army and begged and bummed his way around India, sleeping where he could, walking from place to place, a brave and, dare I say it, perhaps even foolish thing to do if you've ever been to India. A radical thing to do, but he was looking for the truth and he was willing to take some risks to find it. He wanted a life that embodied the truth. So Sangharakshita had decided in his youth that he was a Buddhist and always had been a Buddhist. So it's not surprising, after wandering around in India for a while, meditating in caves, meditating wherever he could find, sleeping wherever he could find, he sought ordination as a Buddhist monk. So he sought ordination as a Buddhist monk into the Theravada tradition of Southeast Asia, mainly because that was just about the only Buddhist tradition he'd ever really come across. So that's what he did. He sought ordination into the Theravada tradition. So this is Sangharakshita being on his ordination. His main Theravada teacher, his main Theravada teacher was this very scholarly and knowledgeable figure of Jagdish Kashyap. In keeping with the sort of radical person he is, Sangharakshita decided after a while that in order to get really beyond his personal egocentric likes and dislikes, what he should do is tell Jagdish Kashyap that he was going to completely forego his own personal will and do whatever he told him to do. I suspect that Jagdish Kashyap found this a bit of a pain, having this chap saying, well, I don't know, I'm not going to say anything, you tell me what to do. I'll just do whatever you tell me. So after a while, Jagdish Kashyap told him, they happened to be in Kalimpong, in the foothills of the Himalayas, and Jagdish Kashyap said to him, stay here and work for the Dharma. So he did. He stayed there and worked for the Dharma. I don't know whether Jagdish Kashyap was clairvoyant, or whether this is just an example of the outrageous good luck that seems to have followed the Western Buddhist order, the Triratna Buddhist order, ever since it started. The outrageous providence that seems to happen when people really put themselves into bringing something new into existence. But Jagdish Kashyap saying that had an incredible effect. It's because he said that we're here in this Buddhist center. It's because he said, stay here in Kalimpong and work for the Dharma, that I can be standing here and talking to you. Because what happened is that while Sangharakshita was staying in Kalimpong, working for the Dharma, the Chinese invaded Tibet. And an awful lot of the most important Tibetan lamas of the 20th century fled from Tibet into India, and many of them settled not a million miles from Kalimpong, near Kalimpong or in Kalimpong. And Sangharakshita got to know them. He was ordained into the Theravadan tradition of Southeast Asia. But he had as his teachers some of the most important, influential, and just sheerly remarkable Tibetan figures of the 20th century. So he had this very, very wide experience of Buddhism. This is him with the Dalai Lama. Not that I think the Dalai Lama was ever his teaching, but he became a very big figure in Indian Buddhism, in Buddhism in India. So he had some of the most remarkable figures from Tibetan Buddhism as his teachers, and indeed as his friends in some cases. And he also had contact with a Chinese, I suppose the best word is hermit, who also was very well versed in Chinese Buddhism. And so Sangharakshita had this experience of being exposed to just about all of the main strands of Buddhism that are active in the world today, of getting a really wide experience of Buddhism from lots and lots of different points of view. And so he was put in a position where he could take an overview, where he could begin to see down to the very roots of what it was all about. That wasn't about what was in one tradition and not in another, but he could start to see, well, what was good about them? What's good about them all? What's good about this one? What's good about that one? And maybe sometimes what's not so good as well. He could start to see the fundamentals that underlied all of them. He developed a vision of the Dharma that transcended any of the traditional schools, went beyond the cultural accretions, the historical accretions, a vision of the Dharma as universal truth that could be applied in the West or anywhere, in any age. So the Triratna story starts with the Buddha, one radical, and it moves on to Sangharakshita, another radical. And then came the 60s, a radical era. So the 60s was a time when a lot of the old certainties were blown away. And a very vibrant alternative culture arose. A counterculture that involved a lot of the brightest young people and was imbued with a lot of idealism about changing the world. It was also imbued with a lot of drugs, which didn't help, and a lot of silliness and a certain amount of self-deception, it has to be admitted. But it was there, the counterculture was there. So in the 60s, there was a terrific amount of interest in Buddhism in the West, in the UK. And this interest took two forms. It had a respectable form, and it had a countercultural form. Okay. So Theravada Buddhism had a respectable intellectual following for a long, long time. Almost as soon as in the 19th century it was discovered, it was scholars latched onto it as a sort of rationalistic, humanistic ethics, very often, ignoring all the mythic and the transcendental elements. And then more recently there'd been a lot of sort of intellectual interest in Japanese Zen. But just about all this respectable interest was purely intellectual. It was purely at the intellectual level. Sangharakshita described it as witty words among the teacups. The people involved rarely meditated. And the last thing they wanted was for Buddhism to change their lives in any significant way. The head of the London Buddhist Society at the time was Christmas Humphreys. And Crispus Humphreys thought that meditation was unsuitable for Westerners, and that Westerners, it was dangerous for Westerners to meditate, they shouldn't do it. He was a high court judge. We still had hanging in those days. And he condemned people to death while being head of the Buddhist Society. He took delight in serving Sangharakshita roast beef for supper. He used to like it and take the mickey out of it for not wanting to eat it. This was Buddhism as a rather polite, rather intellectual hobby. So a leading British Buddhist at the time told Sangharakshita that the most important thing was to make Buddhism respectable. That's what it was all about. We had to make Buddhism respectable. With which he did not agree. Sangharakshita's view is much more that as soon as Buddhism becomes respectable, it has completely lost it. It's transformed into the Church of England. If it's socially acceptable, it can't be liberating anymore. It's going to reflect social values. So we had respectable Buddhism, and we had countercultural Buddhism. This came through the beat poets like Allen Ginsberg and writers like Jack Kerouac and the Dharma Bums. It was part of the beat movement, if you like, and it flowered within the drug culture of the hippie movement. There was lots of supposedly Zen Buddhists who thought smoking dope and taking LSD was meditation, and who wouldn't have survived 10 minutes in the highly disciplined environment of a Zen monastery. But at least there was some life there. At least there was some risk, some willingness to take risks to find the truth, some willingness to step outside the bounds of respectable society, to let the socially constructed self drop away, as the Buddha had asked his followers to do, to let go and break out of socially constructed values, to take some risks to change one's life. These at least were people who thought you should express your values through the way you live and not just consign them to a corner and make them a hobby, while you lived exactly the same way as people who had absolutely no spiritual values at all, which was more the take of respectable Buddhism. So at this time in the 60s, with all this interest in Buddhism in the West, respectable on the one hand, countercultural on the other hand, Sangharakshita, as the most senior British Buddhist monk in the world at the time, the most long-standing British Buddhist monk in the world, was invited by the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara to return to England to teach the Dharma. So he did. He went and he took up residence in the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. Here is the Hampstead Buddhist, here is Sangharakshita in the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. This is the Buddhism he came home to. And this is the Buddhism he founded. He decided the people it was really worth teaching and forming a Sangha with were the countercultural Buddhists, the radicals and the outsiders. There was an incredible sense of freedom at the time. A sense that old ways were falling away and new possibilities were opening up. There was a lot of idealism about changing the world. And Buddhism was part of all this. And Sangharakshita threw himself into that milieu, growing his hair. Even taking LSD, which he described as spiritual baby food. Suitable only for the spiritual toddler. It wasn't long before he was chucked out of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. With the whole respectable Buddhist establishment in the UK tutting at him. So he was a bit of a tuttable figure. So some of the Buddhist establishment, I should say, some of the Buddhist establishment is still tutting, okay? But actually, I think it is hugely to Sangharakshita's credit that he was chucked out of the house in Buddhist Vihara. In the next picture. So, I think the Buddha might have felt a bit like some of the energy that comes off this. Something this picture conveys. A certain edge and energy. And I think I'm really safe in saying that if the Buddha, if he had been transported to England in the 1960s, he would not have been acceptable to the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara or to the London Buddhist Society. He would have been far too radical and far too dangerous and not at all respectable enough. I think the Dharma he taught Buddha, if he had been transported back to England in the 1960s, would not have been the intellectual witty words among the teacups that was bandied around in the Buddhist Society. It would not have been the same as any of the traditional schools. And it would have asked for a lot more radicalism and risk-taking than the folk of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara were used to. And I think the Sangha the Buddha would have founded, if he'd been transported back to Britain in the 1960s, would not have been the respectable, conventional and safe world of the Buddhist Society. It would have been made up of people who were willing to be outsiders, willing to step outside of convention, people willing to take some risks to live a meaningful life. I'm pretty sure the Buddha, that radical wild man, would have started his Sangha among the countercultural Buddhists, not among the respectable Buddhists. And that is what Sangharakshita did. He left the Buddhist Society and the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara to their tut-tutting, and he started a completely new movement from the bottom up. Obviously, this was a bit of an experiment. Well, it was a terrific experiment. He was trying to find ways that the fundamental truths and practices of Buddhism could be practiced in a wholehearted way in this new alien environment, this new alien society. And in the sort of heady days of the 60s, he quite quickly found some quite remarkable people who were willing to throw in their lot with him, to put their energy behind what he was doing. So with no backing from any institution, this new movement started small. It started tiny, and it was strictly a DIY effort. It was a do-it-yourself effort from the bottom up, fueled by radical enthusiasm. So this is the first FWBO centre, I believe, in Archway in London. And anyone know who this is? This chap in the captain, this rather fetching captain.
You?
No. Certainly, I do have to apologise for the way we dressed. Okay. So this young hippie, looking rather floppy, has had a bigger effect on more people than many people who are much more famous. This is Loka Mitra. Loka Mitra, who early on went to India to carry on Sangharakshita's work in India that had started while he was in India among the Dalit community, who became the main driving force behind establishing the Tri Ratna community in India, which now involves huge numbers of people, large numbers of different social projects, several retreat centres, a whole social movement fueled by the Dharma, fueled by people taking their own lives, their own destinies, very much in their own hands on Dharmic principles. And this chap in the captain, he did that. He transformed the lives of many of the most oppressed and socially deprived people in the world. And that, in a way, I think something about that picture and what happened sums up something about the Western, about the Tri Ratna Buddha story. Sorry, sums up something about the Tri Ratna story. From very small beginnings, hole in the wall with friends of the Western Buddhist order, from very small beginnings, like this little centre in Archway, it's grown into something much larger and more worldwide through the commitment of some rather unlikely-looking people. Like this young hippie who has transformed the lives of so many. Like some of the people you know. Mm-hmm. Cue. So who have we got here? You know what my song is?
Oh my god.
So you know who this is? Sangharakshita. Do you know who this is? It's Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet. Do you know who this is? It's Subhuti. Do you know who this is? It's Padma Vajra.
They'd
fetching. It's a rather fetching film.
It's quite dashing.
So it's quite interesting, because Allen Ginsberg in a way represents the previous generation of radicals that were sort of being continued. Next one. So, these are just people. We seem to have red cases, I don't know. Let's carry on. Anyone know who that is? Fine hairstyle. I like the beads. Do you like the beads? Tejananda. Tejananda, anyone who knows Bajraloka, that's Tejananda. Yeah, it was the 60s or 70s.
Something else.
So, who have we got there? Who do we think this is?
That's Papa Badger
again. And rather fetching sort of work. Any ideas? Not a bodie.
And have a badger drinking tea.
And have a badger drinking tea, can't we see?
Yeah.
What have we got here? We've got another body in there.
That's part of badger again.
That's
part of badger
again. And loving.
That's not a body.
Our esteemed president and Vajradhara in the back. Onwards. Any guesses?
Sue City!
Sue City! You can go and study, but you can go and learn meditation with Sue City every 2 weeks on a Sunday. He lives down there.
And every week on a Friday.
David Mitchell, looking rather handsome, I must say. Most people don't know. So there's Sue City becoming an Anglican.
Yeah. Just in case you don't know who Sue City is, that's what he looks like.
Who do you think that is? It's Stirananda. You can study Tai Chi with Stirananda here every Wednesday. So this is what the hippie and archway transformed into. This is David Mitra in India wearing this.
Loka Mitra
in India with his robes.
Again,
that's Pam Jagger. Looking a bit. Looking a bit miserable, actually. There's just lots of pictures of Pam Jagger, I can't.
Oh, that's really cute.
Anyways. So who's this chap? Is this a Latin American revolutionary radio station?
It's Vedanta!
It's
Vedanta! Oh my gosh, that's
funny!
Stand
next to it! This is Vedanta translating for Sangharakshita on a Spanish radio station in the 80s. That was my turn. Okay, that's enough people, So, so just to say, the FWBL, or the tree, as it used to be called then, Tree Ratna, the Tree Ratna Buddhist order community is a radical project. It's a radical project that had radical beginnings in 60s counterculture. It's a do-it-yourself, bottom-up project. It's about transforming energies of the people involved, so that ordinary-looking people end up doing extraordinary things. It's about being involved and making things happen. It's about energy and action and changing things. And I mean that both spiritually and in terms of creating Sangha, creating a movement affecting the world around us. The Tree Ratna Buddhist community is about taking personal initiative, mobilizing energy, doing with others. It's about changing ourselves and it's about changing society. And sometimes in the past, it had a bit of an atmosphere of a revolutionary movement, which is why I think this looks like a Cuban radio station. Calling, the call to arms. So the TBC, the Tree Ratna Buddhist Community, we mustn't call it the TBC. The Tree Ratna Buddhist Community is not about expecting somebody else to do it for you. If we want a Buddhist life, we've got to make it happen. We've got to make it happen. We've got to meditate. We've got to take that choice. We've got to be an active agent and decide where we're going. We've got to be ethical. We've got to change. Nobody else can do it for us, no guru and no God. We've got to create the environment as well that allows us to do that. And that's what it's all been about. So we create centres. We create communities where people can live together and get to know each other and relate in a much deeper way. We create businesses so that people can work with other Buddhists in an environment that creates some spiritual intensity and brings the Dharma in daily life. It's a DIY movement. Next one. So the first bit of DIY is a terrible picture. One of the first really big bits of DIY was doing up the London Buddhist Centre. So taking on this old fire station in the East End of London and transforming it into a Buddhist centre. That's a really poor picture of it, but there you go. And it looked like this. This is how it was done. Yeah? It was guys, just people, not just guys, just doing it, taking on this derelict business and doing it. An awful lot of sweat, an awful lot of fun of people doing things together. Is the building of Guhiloca, that's the building of the men's ordination retreat centre in Spain. It was a bit like that, it was a bit mad. That house, no, it's the next one, fell down and nearly killed somebody. It wasn't a health and safety culture. It was a get it done culture. And that's the crew. Recognise any of them? Look at Bandy. And yeah, Vedana there, looking like a bit too tan. Bit fuzzy. But it's got that feel of more, I don't know, it didn't feel quite like a spiritual movement. It was a bit rough and tough. I don't know why we got that. Do you think that's Sheffield Buddhist Centre? We must have a thing about Georgian porticos. That's Padmaloka. Onwards. And that's just such a 60s picture. Just like that. This is people eating their muesli. They're eating their lunch. Before all sorts of things were built in Padmaloka. So Padmaloka is also a project that loads and loads of building. And it carries on. Sheffield Buddhist Centre before, interesting reredos and damp floor and all sorts of other things, and after. Ta-da! What it looks like now. I mean, we're part of that sort of tradition of making things happen, of people coming together to make things happen, which has sort of grown from that tiny little centre in Archway to, well, what we've got here, among other things. I remember when Sangharakshita came to open this place, I thought, it's amazing. He could never have imagined 40 years ago what would happen from the seeds he'd sown. He'd probably never been to Sheffield. And suddenly he's got this hall full of people opening a Buddhist centre in Sheffield because of what he did, because of the sort of momentum he set in progress. So it's a radical movement, it's a do-it-yourself movement, it's a movement of active engagement. And Sangharakshita put himself outside the respectable Buddhist tradition in the UK. And this made him a very controversial figure for some people. And it attracted a lot of criticism from the more conservative-minded. The Buddha also attracted a lot of criticism from the more conservative-minded. And the movement, the Triratna, what we now call the Triratna Buddhist community, grew up in the heady, permissive, experimental atmosphere of the late 60s and the 70s. Involving a lot of radical young people who went for it like a bull at a gate with perhaps sometimes more enthusiasm than maturity. We didn't have a safety, health and safety culture or a safety first culture at all. Or we wouldn't have achieved anything. So it grew up in that environment and inevitably some mistakes were made. Which, of course, the critics who didn't like Sangharakshita stepping outside conventional Buddhism were delighted by and made much of as they could. So among the mistakes, I would cite a too casual, permissive attitude to casual sex that many people thought should liberate us, but in fact didn't take account of just how powerful sex is, how much emotion is tied up in it. It's emotional power. That definitely happened, but as was pointed out to me, this was the 60s and everybody was like that. What do you expect? That was just part of the way things were at the time. It was a reflection of the times. I would also cite one or two occasions when enthusiasm and idealism veered towards a sort of cultish conformity. So some people lost their individuality and allowed themselves to be pressured into more commitment than they really felt they could really sustain. But this was all a huge experiment, and inevitably mistakes were made. But all of that, it has to be said, is a very, very long time ago now. For at least the last couple of decades, we've settled into a much more settled phase, a much more mature phase. So we've learned from our mistakes. We've become very self-critical. And we are about as far from being a cult as you can possibly get, actually. There's a saying that a cult, the thing that defines a cult, is it's really easy to get into and very difficult to get out of. And in contrast, the Western Buddhist order is almost bloody impossible to get into. And you can leave whenever you like. So, in a way, we're the opposite of a cult. The people involved tend to have developed strong individual personalities, sometimes a bit too much so, I have to say. most of us can't be pushed around very easily at all. Sometimes it would be really good if we could, or some of us could. So we've grown up. And also we've learned to accommodate a much wider range of people. Not just the revolutionary firebrands and the full-time meditators, but also people with careers and families and people of all groups and ages and types. So we're a much more mature movement than we were 40 years ago. And this is a good thing, but it's also potentially got a downside. Back then, to be involved in the Western Buddhist Order, as it was then, was to be part of it all. It was to be part of an exciting project, to be right in there, helping out, building, painting, pickaxing, painting walls, cooking the tea, starting new businesses, finding new venues, whatever. Now, because people have literally devoted their lives to this, we've got lovely Buddhist centres that you can just walk into. We've got well-organised retreat centres. We've got businesses that make money, and it's possible to think somebody else is doing it all. It's possible to think somebody else is doing it all. They are doing it for me. It's possible to just sit back and expect the Dharma to be provided and the Sangha to be created by other people. And it's possible to criticize when it isn't provided. To think that they should be doing it more the way I want it to be done. It's possible to be a consumer of the Dharma rather than a partner in a common project. And even this, in a way, is quite a good thing because it does involve people who haven't got much time, quite peripherally involved. It allows such people to benefit. But there's a danger. If we lose the old enthusiasm and energy, there's a real danger we do that. If we lose the old enthusiasm and energy, it's a real shame for all of us. Because if we turn into the Church of England, we're goners. Okay? If we become part of respectable conventional society, we've lost our edge. We need the cutting edge. We need to stay a radical spiritual movement. We need to stay a bit countercultural. We need the sense of being partners in a common project that's bigger than any individual. We need the sense, above all, we need the sense that it's up to us to make things happen. Nobody else is going to do it for us. We need this because it's absolutely fundamental to the spiritual life, to the Buddhist spiritual life. It creates the spirit of Sangha, for one thing. It allows people to come together and overcome their differences and work together. It brings a bit of the Bodhisattva spirit that allows us to go beyond ourselves, to grow into something bigger than our own little wants and needs and fears. Also, we need this sense of active involvement, active engagement, because it's just the fundamental attitude we need for the spiritual life. By our actions, we create ourselves, and we create the world we live in. That is the basis of the Dharma. Now, I don't mean that we have to keep rushing around all over the place to be active. I mean we need to make firm decisions. We need to decide what we're about and then act on it. We need to be active agents in our own lives and in creating the sort of world we want to live in. So each of us needs to stand up and take responsibility for our own actions. Stop blaming others. Take responsibility for our own actions. See that we are powerful karmic agents, the creators of our own destiny, by the way we act now. So we need to act now to change ourselves. And we need to come together with others to create the sort of environment that allows us to do that and allows us to express what's best in us. And we need to not complain or expect others to do something about it. If we become passive, go floppy, we'll get nowhere. That's one of the main features of our approach to the Dharma, that it's up to each of us. It can't be done for us, although we can do it much more effectively together if we come together to do it. So that's a bit of the tree about the story. And I must say, I'm actually very proud to have been a little part of it. I think an enormous amount has been achieved in 40 years. This rather motley crew that we've been looking at. I think it's almost incredible what's happened. It feels almost as though something was trying to happen and it just used this motley crew to make it happen. So Sangharakshita was heavily involved in, you know, he was a big figure in India while he was practicing in India, and he was heavily involved in the mass conversion of the Dalits to Buddhism under the sort of leadership of Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the Dalits. He was heavily involved in that, which is why he's still regarded with such respect in India and why so many of our brothers and sisters are in India. And he tells the story that he was in Nagpur. Thank you. He was in Nagpur when Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the Dalits, died. And there was a tremendous sense of loss and just, well, we've lost it. If we haven't got our leader, we can't do anything. And he gave these talks, which seemed to have gone a long way towards basically saving the day, making people realize it was up to them. The leader wasn't the one who was going to do it. They had to do it. And he says of this, he says it didn't feel like it was him doing it. It felt like almost like something was doing it through him. It was happening through him. It needed to happen, and he happened to be there, so it did it through him. And he says the same about founding the FWBO, or what we now call the Triratna Buddhist Community. He says that he thought he was a really unsuitable person to found a new Buddhist movement. And it didn't feel like he had founded it. It felt like something much bigger than him had founded it through him. So that is what it has sometimes felt like. It's felt like, well, how did this happen? It's been so lucky. So much luck. So many things have come together to make it work. So you might accuse me of being a sort of superstitious old hippie or something, mystic. But I actually personally do have that feeling. Speaking poetically and mythically, I have to say, speaking poetically and mythically, that there is a sort of transpersonal current of volition which sometimes can manifest through us when we're at our best, when we come together. Which manifests when we come together in the spirit of the Sangha. And which has sort of, if you like, poetically used us as the instrument to create something the world desperately needs. And still acts through us when we get our small self out of the way. And personally, I have to say that moments like that, times when it's felt like that, have been the high spots in my life. for which I'm not only proud but quite grateful. So we need to continue this. We need to continue this. The Sangha is not something that sort of exists and you can just plug into. It's something we need to constantly create, and we need to constantly have this sense of engagement and making something happen. The Sangha isn't something that exists in a permanent way. It's something we need to bring into existence. And all of those motley crew that you've been looking at there have done, some people have given their lives to it, some people have given just a lot of their lives to it, a lot of time and energy to it. But in a sense, you know, it's up to some of you lot as well. If you want to make it happen, it's up to especially the younger people to keep that going and to keep that spirit of radicalism going and not just settle down and let it become the Church of England.